This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, should say host, but also realtors with Oakwind Realty in downtown Vancouver. I'm super excited for today. We've got part deux of the Hot Shots debate here. This is Eric Villagomez, lecturer at UBC SCARP program. He's an independent researcher. He's editor-in-chief for Spacing Vancouver. And then, of course, Bo Jarvis. He is the president and CEO of West Group, prominent development company in Western Canada, one of the largest private real estate development companies in Western Canada. So really excited to have both these guys back on the show, part deux. And let's jump into it. Can't wait.
You know what? Dare I say part deux is better than part
two?
I think it really heats up. I think part two really heats up and we get to some of the crux of the matter.
Yes. This is a good second half, and this is one of the only two-part episodes I think we've ever had on the show.
That's right. Decent amount of feedback for part one.
Yeah. Well, so here's, okay, let's just one and two, because I'm starting to not understand your French. Your own is a little. One of my favorite comments came from a good friend of the show, John Ma, who said, guys, that's got to be the first time, holy F, structured violence, and I'm trying to find a divorce lawyer have been said not only in the same episode, but anytime ever in the history of Vancouver Real Estate Podcast, which is true and a very thoughtful text to receive. A few comments, of course, on the Spotify chat as well, highlighting...
Brandon Augmentson reached out privately with some comments. People are engaged.
well, part two sizzles. So stick around for that, Matt. Before we get to that, of course, we've got the segment that remains nameless.
That's right. We do, Adam. And the segment that remains nameless, of course, always has a quiz component. The stats, you know, I don't want to rely too heavily on the stats, but we are a real estate podcast. The September stats are out.
Yes.
And I drew the question this week from those stats.
Before you get to the question, I was just saying, I did a deep dive on the SNAP stats, sales ratios yesterday. Not many markets, submarkets, at least in Vancouver, that are hovering above a 10% sales ratio right now. So firmly planted in a buyer's market, almost across the board in all the submarkets.
Right. How did Andrew Liss write it? He said, with another cut to Bank of Canada's policy rate behind us and markets pricing in at least one more cut by the end of the year, Metro Vancouver home buyers have reason to be optimistic about the fall market. And the first time I read that, I thought he meant home sellers, meaning that the market's heating up, but he actually was referring to buyers, which was kind of a little bit of a bait and switch on maybe the logic of that. But anyway, let's just say September was an interesting month.
That's kind of the best unintended line,
I think. I know. I read it. I had to read it three times. I was like, wait, what? Oh, home buyers have, which is true. It's a great time to be a buyer, that's for sure. Adam, the question this week is, and this kind of we dovetail into this. In September 2025, the total number of properties listed for sale on the MLS system in Metro Vancouver was 17,079. How does this compare to the 10-year seasonal average? And I have a couple, this is multiple choice. I didn't want to put you too on the spot. Is it A, 14.4% above the 10-year average? B, 25.2% above the 10-year average? C, 36.1% above the 10-year average? Or D, 46.3% above the 10-year average?
Very interesting.
While you're thinking about that, Adam, we have...
It's been a while to jump in there.
An incredible new listing, and I think you want to take the lead on this. You'll be there this weekend.
Yeah, Matt, I'm so excited for this listing. We've got a brand new, it's never been lived in before, townhouse at Format by Cressy, which is one of my favorite buildings in Vancouver. I think it's just, it presents so well, this building. Incredible amenities.
Stunning.
Yes, this is, of course, 2-bed, 2.5-bath townhome on 2 levels. And that's the key, really, is that the space, almost 1,200 square feet, is on 2 levels, which people that have looked at townhomes will really appreciate that, because once you get the 3-level townhomes and it's about 300 or 400 square feet per floor, it starts to feel really tight. This does not feel that way at all.
This is not stacked studios, Adam.
No, exactly. So, of course, it's got air conditioning, really beautiful modern aesthetic. The interiors are by St. Marie Studio, which former guest on the podcast. Of course, kitchens. Everybody knows the Cressy kitchen, which is trademarked.
That's TM'd.
Cressy's kitchens are unbelievable. So you get the full benefit of the Cressy kitchen and spectacular amenities with 2 expansive outdoor patios. These are rooftop decks. One's got a pizza oven, which I love.
Yeah.
They've also got amazing outdoor spaces on the rooftop deck, a fantastic children's play area, co-working spaces, a fitness center, some of the best views. The views on this rooftop deck, Matt, are unbelievable. And of course, this unit comes with EV parking and storage. And you can see it on our site, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com, listed for $1,099,000.
For brand new product, Adam?
This just unbelievable.
Almost 1,200 square feet.
I know. Incredible.
I just want to make 2 points here. One, where else in East Van can you get a concrete townhome? I think this is
tricky.
I said to somebody at the office and they said, is that the only concrete townhomes that exist in East Van? I said, one of the few for sure. If not the
only
one.
Sounded like Trump when you said
I'm like,
it.
I'm doing a Donald Trump there. And second of all, Adam, you're not getting crushed by this stratify. Yeah. You get the amenities of a concrete high rise and their beautiful amenities without a crushing stratify, which people hate, of course.
It's the lowest.
In other areas.
It's the lowest stratify.
It's a fantastic stratify, Adam. It's a terrific stratify. But yeah, this is a great... Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com to check it out. Yeah, while you're there, of course, click Sell With Us, where you can download the sold plan. That's start on launch date. This is for anyone looking to get their property ready for sale. You want to use this as a step-by-step guide to get your property ready for market. That's the sold plan at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Go there to check out this great listing.
Yeah, Matt. And one more thing before we get back to that question, but we had one comment that came in this week requesting a book list of all the recommended books from the 5 Wire over the years. I think we got to figure out how to compile that list. But if you would be interested in that list, flip us a DM or a text, because if enough people out there want it, maybe we'll have to build it.
Yeah, or sign up at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. And yeah, maybe I think ChatGPT might be part of the answer, Adam, to what you're looking for in terms of how to build that. But but it will take some work. Let's get back to the quiz question, Adam. Now, I'm just going to read it quickly because we went a little outside the regular time there, focusing on that unbelievable townhome at Format. In September 2025, Adam, the total number of properties listed for sale on the MLS were 17,079. How does this compare to the 10-year seasonal average? 14.4, 25.2, 36.1, or 43.3?
Matt, I'm going to go with C.
Now, have you read the stats, Adam?
I have not. My logic here is I'm basing that off of, I seem to think that the 10-year average was maybe around 11,000-12,000 or so. So I'm just kind of, yeah, that's what I was basing it on. Yeah, but that was from memory.
No, you are correct. The 10-year seasonal average is 12,553.
Yeah.
So you are correct. You are correct. Oh, it was 36.1%. I think that takes you from 82% to 84% in terms of correct answers guessed. So congratulations to you. And maybe we should cut to our talk with our debate, should we say, or dialogue with Eric Villagomez and Bo Jarvis. This
Can't
one
wait.
Gets heated.
The Five Wire is brought to you by Atlin at Clayton Crest, a master plan community in the West Clayton area built by Zentera Developments.
Zentera is an absolute force, Adam. They've been recognized as Multifamily Home Builder of the Year for 10 years in a row and just won again at the Georgies for 2025 Multifamily Home Builder of the Year.
What's really exciting about Atlin is the West Clayton location. You're within walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, giving you that perfect balance of city access while living in a peaceful, family-friendly community in the Fraser Valley.
And if you have kids or are planning to start a family, there's an on-site daycare where residents get first access. This kind of thoughtful planning is why Zentera's projects stand out in the market.
The amenities at Atlin are incredible too, Matt. A rooftop patio with stunning views, fitness center, co-working space, and lounge areas for events. The outdoor space is extensive with two fitness areas, three children's play areas, and multiple spots to relax.
With major investments happening in the SkyTrain and the 72nd Avenue extension, West Clayton is set for explosive growth. This is genuinely one of those opportunities to invest in a community before values skyrocket.
And that's really the key here. This isn't just about finding a beautiful place to live. It's about making a smart investment in your future as the whole area continues to develop.
Pre-sales for Atlin will begin soon. Register today at atlincondos.ca. That's atlincondos.ca.
Right now, we're not rebuilding fast enough and it's causing displacement. Or we're planning in areas that are, you know, for renewal where there's high levels of this affordable aging stock. And I think that's David Lay's kind of thing. And that's a problem for sure.
Yeah.
But that's my kind of diatribe on like the system and what's going on. And I do think it's working, in fact, at a broad level.
So I would agree and disagree in certain
you
kind
can't
of specific
disagree,
areas. No. I can't. I'm not going to do it. But I think that there's an important thing about the filtering system. I think one of the most reasonable ones that I've read and looked at was one that actually was slightly more nuanced. So it wound up saying, okay, this filtering can work, but you need a certain amount of information, this data set. And one of the data sets that it wound up having, which I have, again, I tried to find here, from what I understood, even within the city, that it doesn't exist, had to deal with what was called housing consumption, which is actually kind of the actual square footage of the people in need. And that those, once you had income and had these two graphs, and it was a wonderfully beautiful and elegant system, would lead to a better understanding of who needs and then direct policy and development and supply within the sector that it was required. Now, I would argue that actually can't even exist right now, simply because that information isn't even being collected. So the CMHC, I think, again, I think it works in certain areas. I think that filtering via the CMHC belief, which is a value system, which again, I would argue in the power dynamic, but it does work, but it's nuanced. And I think in other places, it's just a mess. It doesn't work at all.
I don't think we're dealing with deeply affordable.
Okay.
Hard to house. You know, single moms that like we're not getting there.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm not even talking about deeply affordable. I'm talking about just whatever affordable. And even something very specific, like something that, again, that I wound up going in Barcelona and in they have actually clear definitions. They're like, this is what affordable means in monetary terms. It's like this much per month, right? This is what the number is, which is something. And I would argue that I would be as frustrated as anybody, even if I, being a developer, I'm like, give me, what are you talking about? Give me something that I can work with here and be clear and transparent about it instead of being
consistent
and consistent.
Yeah.
Instead of being random. It seems like it's just all levels currently, hopefully it will change, but there's randomness everywhere. Like there's inconsistency. People are using different things. They wind up going, the numbers are kind of like, what does this mean? Why is this affordable? If it's below market, if it's $5 below market, is that below market? And what is market then? Give me the number, please. And to the layperson, again, in Barcelona, they're like, here's what you're in an affordable unit, in quotes, this is what your rent will be per month, period. So someone can look at it and say, yes, I understand it. Now we can't, right? So, and I think that that's a data thing. I think it's a consistency thing. I think it's a policy thing. I think it's, you know, when you were like, you know, can the government even have the expertise? I'm like, I think it's an expertise thing. I think that there's so many different facets to this, going back to the complexity issue, that it's very difficult. And again, I empathize 100% with the development side of things. And if you narrow in on your numbers and what the assumptions that you're made, I'm like, I understand 100% why you're frustrated, why all of these kind of components are going in. On the other hand, I could also empathize with all the other people that seem to come my way that are like, I understand you're getting kicked out of a house and those folks are asking for more money, right? And that's going back to who? Who is it going back? It's going back to landlords, developers. And I'm like, okay, so who's it? Again, you're just weighing all of these different things. And that's where I think the idea of complexity is an important variable. And I think it's important, again, to state something very, very clear, is that we're dealing with the highest order of complexity here that has ever existed. And we're dealing with it simultaneously. One, economies. If we knew how to do economies, you know, it would be the silver bullet, beautiful. If we knew how to predict populations, fantastic. No, we don't. And then how does that relate to urbanization? All of these things are happening simultaneously. All three, that we can't even figure out one of them, let alone all three simultaneously. And I think that that's where I'm going to go back to the very, very practical things, is that's why we have to talk together. That's why there's no expert. That's why there's multiple people having multiple issues that are very real and that are relevant, and that we all have to just get in a room and just figure something out for our sake, right? Because if we don't, if we keep kind of going and being like this and that and this, and you're not an expert and you are an expert, and I'm like, actually, we're kind of, again, kind of missing the point. It's such a complex issue. And housing, the problem of housing is the problem of cities and vice versa. Like it's, housing takes up the vast majority of any city. Historically, it's fact. So how we decide to build it, and I agree, supply is a part of this game. And even in the letters, it says, supply is a part of this.
Yeah.
The question is not that it isn't a part, it's a specific type.
But right? It's also the scale, right? Because scale, I mean, it's more of a gentle density approach, like I infill and, you know.
That's right. So the idea is, within the context of the letters, is that they're kind of mid-rise, they're gentle density, they're infills. And again, this goes back to, how would you come up with that? One, now you're weighting multiple variables. So all of a sudden it's like, okay, actually, when you look at, in the absence of kind of low carbon concrete, which I know you're experimenting with, actually, really interesting. Yeah.
We've completed two developments.
That's right. In the absence of that, you're going to want more sustain, because we don't want to destroy our planet in the midst of this. And we want to see what's there. There's going to be much more kind of community buy-in by that, because, you know, it's not as extreme. You know, it's changing a quote unquote single family home to a tower is extreme. And people innately will go against that. Innately. Like, it's just human. It's like, this is not going to kind of work. And there are multiple reasons for that, which I'm happy to get into, but I won't. But so there's that idea of, we agree, supply 100%. So here are points of agreement. Supply is critical. Type, we're not discounting towers.
I don't give a shit about type.
Yeah.
Honestly, I'd rather not build another high rise for the rest of my life. You think about the risk that's buried in building a high rise.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, so no, we're aligned there.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that, and it, you know, the first time Bo and I met, it was under the guise I actually think we're more aligned than we're not. And this is where I was like, you know, there's not mistrust. I don't mistrust any Bo and any of the stuff that he's saying. And I think we're actually more aligned. I think that some of the details, little sticky points, maybe some of the assumptions that are made, some of the numbers, but I appreciate, for example, you got to use a number for something. Why not use CMHC? CMHC is government. Like, I understand that. So there are a whole bunch of things that we actually generally align with.
I just want to because Matt's got a great question, but before we get to that, I just thinking about your research that you've done in other cities, like say Barcelona, like are there cities or countries that can inform like a role of government, what role the government could play?
Oh,
or are there, and can you talk a little bit about that? Like, how do you actually see, you mentioned earlier that government needs to step up.
Yeah.
There's a lot of questions around that, but how do you see that kind of unfolding?
So it's been interesting. So I actually started with a colleague by the name of Devin Harlows. We looked at the situation here and we were like, people need to get out. Like, there's just too much echo chamber going on here. So we decided to kind of go and we just randomly started these urban planning field schools. So for professional planners, not for students, professional planners. And we choose cities based on things that they can teach us here. So first time we went to Barcelona, and then I wound up going, we meet with people within the field, in the housing ministry there. We did a whole bunch of things. Most recently, it was Singapore. Two different, seemingly very different places, but have a lot of similarities. And how they deal with it. So in Singapore, for example, the government owns 80%, 90% of the land. And they are the developer, for the most part, and the planner. They're pretty much the full package. And some of the issues that they're dealing with are really, really interesting. Again, I'll leave that maybe for another session. But so their role is very, very explicit. They wind up going in and they build and they plan for housing for everybody. Now, 80% of the people there live in public housing. And it's all of the things that we take for granted here are kind of, it's like a bizarro world. It's like the upside down there. You know, I mean, if you want to use a Stranger Things reference, where you have people on the 50th floor of a building that are paying virtually nothing, like relatively. Here, it would be like when we were there, we were going up and down and we just met, you know, elderly couple, 50th floor. So that cost stratification where here we're used to, you know, that's a penthouse, right? Like the view from their place was just like, oh my God, it's amazing. But there it's not monetized. But they have a whole bunch of levers which would make, so there it was really interesting because the planners kind of cringed simultaneously at the same time as they were kind of like, I understand. So one thing, for example, is it's a lottery system, A. So no one can choose their location. And location here is tied very strongly to land value, right? So, you know, whether you're in Kitts or whether you're in Langley or whatever, all these things are different. So they take that away, for example. They also have, which I think was one of the most interesting things, they have something similar to the pension, the CPP here, right? Pension fund there that they have for housing. So they take out of everyone's paycheck money that goes towards housing. So by the time that they can apply for it, they're not paying cash. They're actually, it's like it's already paid and it goes through their system. Now, again, there are some caveats to that. That I think, again, are kind of like who qualifies for that? Who doesn't qualify? These are all pertinent and important questions. But some of those things I think are really interesting. The idea of creating and manipulating taxes, which we do all the time anyway, but in a way that kind of fosters a more stable long-term income flow for the construction of housing.
The one thing about Singapore is it was that way from day one.
That's right. It was that's that.
Important. So, right?
It's critical.
To rebuild that, you need to start a new city.
That's right.
That's part of it is like, is there something that's not a systemic change, right? I mean, are there directions we can go that from where we are now, which is not just
incremental?
That's right.
Incremental.
That's right. So what winds up happening, so this is, I'm reversing purposefully. The Barcelona model arguably is more like ours. And theirs, again, had a very similar mode. Fundamentally, government came in at all levels. So there they have it at three giant levels. I'm going to oversimplify the system, but the EU, they have Spain, and then they have Barcelona. So they have the kind of overarching, they have the country, and then they have the municipality. Each one offered different monies that went towards housing. And it had a series of different rules and regulations around land and how land was used and the value of each plot and how it kind of went across, and a series of policies that limited things like height, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that wound up going, and again, they wound up over the past 8 years building a ridiculous number of affordable housing. And what they both have in common, so what I'm interested in is, yes, there are different things. One was day one, one is not. One is bottom up, one is top down. All of them had a few key things, which I've already mentioned and we've already discussed. Both of them were very clear on what things like affordability is and numbers associated with construction and rents and all of that different type of stuff. Both of them were very, very, they worked to a certain degree. Singapore is getting better. Barcelona started from the bottom. So I had all the people involved in it. So everyone was making decisions together so that everyone was on the same page. And clarity was critical to all of these facets. So for both of them, clarity is critical.
They de-risked it.
That's right. De-risking.
You want to take the profit out of housing, de-risk it.
That's right.
Right? Yeah. You want to have capital, you want to attract capital that is tolerant of a lower return, de-risk it. Create more certainty, right?
Correct.
Our governments are sucking and blowing, right? We know that. Right? They're on the one hand wanting to solve the cost of delivery, affordability. On the other hand, they are taxing the shit out of it. If you go to our province's forecasted provincial budget, and it was last year I looked at this, it was item 3 or 4, I believe, just behind income tax and resource royalties, was revenue from real estate. On our provincial budget, and there's probably 100 or more items on there, it was like 3 or 4. So to say that, you know, we want to, you know, build more housing that's more affordable for deeper levels of affordability and all this kind of stuff. At the same time, they're reaping huge amounts of revenue from the delivery of housing. And why are we not having that conversation? Like, why are we not just being super honest about that?
Yep.
Right? And again, these siloed conversations, sound bites on one side of the conversation constantly. Yep.
That's right. And that transparency, I think, is critical. The transparency, Barcelona was very transparent, again, in terms of definition, and to the public. And they showed all the things. They collected data. Amazing. They created their own housing data center as a part of an extension of the municipality. Everyone was working off the same set markets as they wound up going up and down. It was like, here, and it was all public. You could go in and you could get it. It's like, oh, okay, you know, why is my rent this? Well, here's why. And it's, everything is very clearly laid out. So there's all of these different types of things. And I think, you know, it's in this book somewhere in all of my notes is the word de-risking right away. It's just first, number one, you have to de-risk it. And the question then becomes how important. But those conversations, again, can't be siloed. And it's just fostering a very distrustful, I would say, environment across the board. I think, again, you know, people don't trust, right? Even if governments are well-meaning and the numbers are right, it's like, I don't believe you. Well, why wouldn't you believe us for the government? Well, it's like, actually, you've been kind of holding a lot close to the chest. And we don't know where these things are coming out from historically, at least. And even it seems to be getting more opaque now. You know, FOIs are being sent out all over the place. And I think even West Group might have sent an FOI or two where it's like, where are you getting this stuff from? We don't even know where you're coming from.
For sure. Yeah, yeah.
Right? So there's a whole bunch
of stuff. Who would have ever thought, eh?
It's crazy. It's totally crazy.
It's crazy. This is the environment that we're currently playing in.
It's a Winston Churchill quote. Democracy is the worst form of government except for all the other tribes.
Well, we've talked about a lot of things. One thing we haven't talked about that I wanted to touch on before we wrap up, but so the two letters had very different takes on, and I know, Bo, you didn't sign it, but foreign investor. And I'm kind of more interested in, you know, we can talk about foreign investor, foreign investment, but just investors in general, right? Because we're talking about the type of housing came up, you know, the idea of the supply, the gentle density. It just makes me think of my neighbor who tried to build a laneway house and it was like destroyed 6 years of her life. It cost over $1 million in the end. And she just got caught in a process where she didn't understand what was going. She got taken, I think, but it was insane. Anyway, the question I have, and maybe we'll start with Bo, are real estate investors providing a service or destroying our city?
I would argue on the side of providing a service, but let's, again, complex question, complex answer.
Simple questions.
That letter that came out, that there were a number of signatories from our industry. I think that, and I'm just going to be totally candid, I've said this to a number of my peers in the industry, some of which who signed the letter. I said, there's extremely poorly executed strategy. Because let's go back to the top. Okay, so if we believe, again, CMHC's numbers, right? Like this is this number that has been most widely used by our politicians and our policymakers. Again, park whether we disagree with it or if we could dismantle those numbers. Let's just park that for a second. We know that there's rationale as to how they came up with them. They didn't just sort of, you know, pull it out of you know where. So that then leads to a capital requirement. Okay, so RBC has suggested that that capital is $2 trillion. $2 trillion that's currently not in the system. Fraser Institute has suggested that it's about $1.6 to $1.8 trillion that's currently not in the system. To put that in perspective, our trustee pension funds in Canada are valued at about $2.2 trillion. And all of that capital is allocated. Okay? So where are we getting this capital from? It doesn't exist domestically, right? And so how are we going to attract that capital regardless of what the delivery platform is? So say it's the government delivering 50% of this. Where's the capital coming from? That capital has to come from somewhere. And that capital requires a risk-adjusted return. Okay? Who seeks risk-adjusted returns and deploys capital? The investor. And that can be an institutional investor. It can be a corporate investor. It can be a private investor. It can be mom and pop. It can be Eric. It can be Bo, Matt. Politics 101 is creating a villain, getting everybody on board with the villain, and then finding a solution to deal with the villain, regardless of whether there's any truth in that whatsoever, right? And so foreign buyers, and this is like, you know, when the whole foreign buyer thing was going on, it was the previous liberal government that put the first foreign buyers tax in place. And at that time, we looked in our portfolio of buyers and we had a lot of housing going on at that time. It was under 2% that would be considered a foreign buyer. Now, there were some actors in our market that were indeed having sales centers operational in like China and Hong Kong. That was going on, right? And I think that it became a villain. I think if you, like I ChatGPT'd this question the other day, in Metro Vancouver, during that time, it was about 8%. 8%. Of transactions were some foreign buyer. Now, is that something that's contributing to affordability in a major way? I don't know. I mean, I guess some could argue that 8% is a big number and some could argue that it's not that meaningful. Did it require all of the intervention that occurred in the form of various taxations and bans and moratoriums on foreign buyers that effectively has pushed away any investor into Canada, whether it's real estate, whether it's mining, whether it's anything? You know, out of OECD nations, when you look at, if you're an investor and you're looking at, you know, where Canada sits on the rankings of OECD nations, I think we're dead last on regulatory framework. And last year, we were in the bottom five in terms of attracting foreign direct investment. And so, like, you got to ask yourself, why is that? So, you asked, is the investor bad? Is the investor needed? I think the investor is needed. You have to understand what the investor is, what the investor is seeking, and we can regulate how our housing is used regardless of how it's invested in, right? So let's go to the foreign buyer, and there's the Australian model, where they allow foreign capital, a foreign buyer, to buy new housing, and they restrict the use. So that means in that, and I haven't delved into the actual use restriction, but in my mind, that can mean you force them to put it into the rental market so it doesn't sit vacant, or you force them to occupy it, or it is taxed, right? So what's wrong with that? So we just canceled the project last week, made headlines, 6 o'clock news, 202 units. We canceled it, gave everybody terminated contracts, gave everybody's deposits back. There were zero investors out of the pool of buyers that had, you know, signed contracts to get this project going. We can't move the project forward and get financing from the banks without satisfying the presale test. To satisfy the presale test, it'd be nice to have investors interested, right? Get the housing built if you believe in filtering. Have those investors forced to put it into the rental pool or live in it or whatever. It's not going to sit empty. And so I just, we overcorrected in my mind. And we can talk about the financialization of real estate. And we can talk about REITs. And we can talk about all that kind of stuff. And if you really distill down and dig into the details and the metrics and the data, a lot of it's bullshit. It really is. You know, did we need an empty housing tax? I was supportive of an empty homes tax. Now, I'm not supportive, Eric, of...
looking at me, everyone.
We talked about this. The empty homes tax applying to standing new inventory.
Right.
Okay? And that's a very, very important distinction. That is absolutely and fundamentally unfair. But I am supportive of an empty homes tax. In an affordability crisis, when we have a housing crisis and people don't have places to live, there should not be housing sitting unoccupied, right? But, you know, on the new inventory, that's a separate conversation. We delivered the daycare and kids are in there with their crayons. We built the traffic light and the cars are stopping at the red light. And now we have to be taxed on our standing inventory and all of that other stuff was predicated on us making a profit. Like, bullshit. We'll never develop again if that's how you want to, like, you know. Anyway, I'll shut up now. That was a long-winded answer. You go, Eric. You go.
No.
Investors, bad or good?
Investors, bad or good.
Thank you, Bob.
Investors, bad or good. I appreciate that. And
hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown. And we're the founders of Oakland Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia.
Serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakwin, please reach out to us at oakwin.com/join and type into that message box, the rep, and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much. And we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
This podcast is sponsored by Jethro Condos in downtown Langley. Over 100 homes under $425,000 with one-bedroom suites starting at $399,900.
Here's what's incredible, Adam. These condos actually cash flow. When's the last time we could say that about new construction in the Lower Mainland? With these entry-level prices, the numbers actually work for investors.
And you're in the heart of downtown Langley, surrounded by trendy cafes, artisan bakeries, and parks. The area is experiencing incredible growth and new development.
Yeah, the location is absolutely key. Jethro is steps from the future Langley SkyTrain station. Get in before that transit connection transforms the area. Because once that SkyTrain arrives, you're looking at direct connections across the Lower Mainland.
Jethro is a Whitetail Homes project. Whitetail Homes has over 25 years of experience with quality construction and finishes that exceed expectations. We're talking vibrant interiors, expansive windows, and thoughtful design.
For realtors listening, they are offering amazing cooperative incentives. This is a rare opportunity where the fundamentals make sense. Affordable entry, cash flow potential, and positioned for major transit infrastructure in all around win.
Register at jethrocondos.ca. That's JETHRO condos.ca.
Jethro Condos, distinctly Langley, uniquely yours.
I think I would say it depends. It really kind of depends. I think it depends on really what the ultimate result is. So if the result is kind of longer term, more stable homes for most people and those in need, then thumbs up. I think this is one of the cases where I think the devil's in the details, right? So investment, I think, is a really interesting thing. It's caused all types of havoc, as we know. The examples of that are countless. You know, even in the places that I went, in Singapore, it's really interesting. They were like, because they're so top down, they were like, we took this block and then we saw what the market did and we opened it up and it was just mayhem. And they're like, no. And then, so they keep these little pilot projects, but a lot of it, the devil is in the details. It's how do you wind up executing investors and that money and that inflow in And I think it's critical. I think a lot of the discussions, again, we're not even talking about, you brought it up, but I didn't kind of follow up with it. It's a whole separate discussion about declining populations. What does that mean? What does that mean for growth, if you want to call it that, or maintenance or economies? Like, all of these things are part of this puzzle, right? So I guess that the question would be, can it do good? Yes. It can also do bad. So I think, you know, the highly leveraged, highly speculative that leads to all types of land values going up unnecessarily, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's been proven, as we know, it's been quite damaging. So this is where a really, really, really strong set of policies, well thought out, I think can make a difference here. And I think it can wind up going, again, kind of either way. But I guess the question would be, do you have confidence that such a thing could be done, whether given the governments and the policies that we've seen relatively recently? It's a separate question.
And what about, it's a little unclear to me, the argument around, I mean, I understand the cost of land when it's underutilized and there's a best use and the land values go up. That seems very straightforward. In the letter I was reading, there's a couple of interesting points. One is, you know, we have to take speculation out of the market. We've built more housing over the last 20 or 30 years, and don't quote me, but I'm just thinking in relation to the population, and we have to, you know, fight against inflated land values. And it was a little bit unclear to me how those kind of all jive.
Yeah. So that's a complex, again, very complex question to a certain degree. And I was hearing the paper as we all were hearing. I'm gonna let Bo take this one for now. Set. Look at this thing.
Maybe I'll even just reframe it. Like how do we remove speculation, I guess, is one thing. And what is the negative role it's played in housing? But maybe, Bo, you don't have to answer that. If you got your pie chart,
I brought data.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, love it.
Speculation has played a role.
Yeah.
It has.
But it has to in the current model, right?
It's about finding balance, right? So there are stories where you've seen, buyers of land flip it in these moments in time where you saw aggressive capital appreciation on land, and they've made tens of millions of dollars with doing nothing. It's just pure speculation play. I don't think that's healthy for any market, right? That is not, I would not be advocating for that. But there are very, very much true stories about that. I think that we have addressed that. I think the idea of land speculation is entirely moot at this point. In fact, I think we've overcorrected to the degree that we are now finding ourselves with underutilized land that is on SkyTrain stations that is more valuable in its current form as, say, a shopping center, a strip mall with a surface level parking lot, than it is as a development land. A piece of development land with, you know, housing and a daycare and the commercial amenities that you might see in a high density development next to a transit station. And this piece of paper that you heard rattling around here, this is a site. This is in a Metro Vancouver city, and this has a surface level grocery anchored strip mall on it next to a SkyTrain station. Okay, so the land value as development land is $41 million. Total government fees, municipal DCCs, regional DCCs, so that's Metro Vancouver, and then density bonus payments to the city and the CACs, community amenity contributions, total government fees are $206 million. So government is getting $206 million out of this development. It drives the land value of the development potential down to 41. The asset value in its current use is valued at $61 million, a $20 million delta. We have overcorrected. Mm-hmm. We extracted the speculation out of the market, right? And to be clear, you have to leave some money for that situation. The development land value needs to be at a number that is more than its current use, yeah, right? And it has to be at a number that's more that incentivizes the seller to sell. And don't forget, they're dealing with capital gains exposure and whatever else, right? So that number, again, the value of that asset's worth 61. The land residual and the development potential is currently worth 41 based on all those fees. That probably needs to be at about 80. There needs to probably be about $20 million of profit for those people selling that land that have operated that strip mall. And you don't know what their story is. Maybe there was tenants in the strip mall and the CRUs that, you know, were struggling in 1994 and they let them get by rent free for 6 months while they, you know, like they were maybe good community members. They paid their mortgage. They did this. And so we have to move away from there can be zero profit on that land sale. There's got to be some profit. There's got to, and we just have to find policy that balances this out. Today, this conversation is moot as far as I'm concerned.
So hard to argue with a pie chart, especially a colored one. I think the my main thing would be to kind of, again, step back and say that speculation fundamentally is just that. It's people guessing at what might happen and that influencing the cost, whether it's real or not, right? Whether it's quote unquote, let's call it real. And we could kind of go back to property rights and all this different type of stuff. Not going to touch that right now. But I think is it gone? I would not say it is gone. So we would potentially disagree on that. I'd say that there have been many measures trying to moderate it 100%. It still winds up happening. I'm not going to mention a project that I promised I would never mention again after the last conversation we wound up having. But you know which one I'm talking about.
I do.
But you can mention it if you want. I made a promise. I said, look, I'm going to say this once and I'm just going to leave it at that and I'll never mention it again. So I'm a man of my word.
But you're right to mention that project in that context. And that's the Curve downtown.
Hey, he mentioned it. Let the record show.
The reason I said he's not allowed to mention anymore is we in the industry all knew that was a failure from day one. So stop using it as the poster child for failure when we know there's thousands of projects that have produced the CACs and the childcare and the affordable housing.
That's right.
But you're right to use it.
That's right. I appreciate that you used it, Bo, and that I did not use that. I really appreciate that. So I think that one of the key things there is that, again, it does happen. It is real. These things do wind up really negatively affecting, you know, markets and inflating things. So is it completely gone? I think that there have been attempts to do that. I think there are some bigger questions around, you know, if the government's getting all this money, right? Assuming that this beautiful pie chart is correct. And I'm going to assume the best in you, which I always do, Bo.
I took it off all of their posted rates on their website.
Great. So assuming those things are correct, you look at that and you're like, oh, that's a lot of money going to the government. So the question is, where is that money even going, right? Where is it? How is it not kind of going and manifesting in very particular ways that we can see results on the ground? And clearly that's not happening at all. So again, a lot of these question marks, and that's where it goes back to, where's the transparency? If I'm looking at these numbers, the question should be, what are you doing with this? And there should be like, oh, this is what we're doing with it. This is how it's going. And there are a whole bunch of different things that are kind of being thrown out in the world about kind of the bloating of cities and it going to, you know, management. None of this can be proven, to be clear. As you can imagine, it's virtually impossible to, you know, call up the city. Hey, did you get X number of people? And how much are you paying them, by the way? I'd like to know, just to weight that against my spreadsheet. Not going to happen. But there have been a lot of monies being taken. And it's important to recognize that these are public money. So this is public money, ideally. It's supposed to be, it goes to the government. It's supposed to be back into the public interest in some way, shape, or form. The fact that it is not, or it doesn't seem to be, I think is a critical question here, right? And that should kind of go back into the bigger sphere and the conversation should be happening, which it's not, as Bo rightly pointed out. So there are these things, again, that are making this
difficult. It's also perpetuating a narrative that is, we don't get enough out of development.
Yes.
The public is not getting enough out of development, right?
Right.
No. So there's that. And again, this could all be settled if someone would actually be like, this is actually what we're doing and this is how much it's being. I was in a presentation given by a fellow developer of yours who I will remain up there, who's given me all the numbers. Again, just here's 15%. This is how much is going to city. And it's really interesting. You know, there are a lot of things we don't talk about. A lot of things, you know, lenders, and I'm going to That's it. I could feel the haters come up here. From the, I could just feel it. I felt it. Did you feel that? Do you feel that, everyone? The lenders that are requiring things like pre-sales and like those money, that money is large. Like if, again, I'm sure you have several spreadsheets. I've seen several. It's like for major developments, these are huge. These are millions of dollars, right? And again, how do you wind up going? How do you negotiate that? So again, everyone kind of has to be on the table in here. And I apologize to all those who right now are pinning my face on their dartboard after saying that. But I think it's an important piece of the puzzle. There's a number of people and what I'm going to call a building culture here. And that building and culture includes developers. It includes architects. It includes lenders. It includes marketers. It includes, like, it's a whole ecosystem, each of which is taking little pieces along the way. And it's that ecosystem that has to be addressed. I don't think it's fair to put it on any one of these folks to resolve a problem that's an ecosystem. I think it's everyone who has to kind of go in there and to recognize their role in perpetuating some of these problematic issues.
Got one more question for you guys.
Do it.
Yeah, I love it.
This isn't an ideal world. Do you want to?
Well, no, please.
Okay.
Hopefully, Bo will bring out another chart.
We are running long, Adam. You're right. This might be our longest podcast we've ever done. So,
Eric talks a lot.
This is so funny. I'm going to tell you again a completely random story. My son, on my way out here today, he was like, can I listen to the podcast? And I'm like, no, it's going to be pre-recorded and edited. He's like, hey, what? They don't need to edit a podcast. I said, I'm going on the podcast. Yeah. They're going to need some editing, boy. They're going to need some editing.
As a final question, 15 years out, what in your mind does Vancouver look like ideally? Did we manage this crisis and get out of it? Are things fundamentally different?
Yeah. 15 years out. You know, I hope that housing is less politicized. And I hope that we stop, like, again, back to Churchill's quote, right? Where regarding democracy, we politicize things for power structures to stay in place, right? And if we can move away from the politicization of housing and really have honest conversations and get to pragmatic approaches to delivery, and maybe that's something that, you know, it can never happen because of our structure. But if we can do that, I feel like in 15 years, you know, we should be able to start to balance out the issue where we have more housing for more people at more affordable prices. And so I believe that we can get there. It will be a grind, right? It will be. Our government doesn't have any money. We forgot to say that in this podcast, right? Our provincial government and our federal government are running historic deficits. They don't have any money. And so that's going to be a major challenge moving forward, is how do we operate in this system where we want the public sector to come in and take up more of the ecosystem. We want the private sector to succeed also and create jobs and take risk and generate a risk-adjusted return. Yeah, how does all that happen? And so I believe in 15 years, we can get there. But it's going to take, honestly, more conversations like this and less polarization of the issue. We have to come together. There's going to be compromise. There's going to be compromise and sacrifice on all sides of the issue to come together and develop policy that is sustainable and does not yield unintended consequences. And if unintended consequences do rear their head, fix it right away. Like, fix it.
Yeah, I think I'll echo a lot of that. I think, you know, we're talking in ideals here. I think the next, ideally in the next 10, 15 years, you'll see, you know, renters and owners have real security. You'll see governments being more transparent. There'd be more consistency in terms of the data. There'd be more open conversations. There'd be a mix of housing types and housing tenures. Again, all that that are secure over the long term. That there'd be lower carbon footprints and emissions. It would be, you know, a more socially just society. this would be the ideal. I think, I don't know whether that will occur, obviously. I think there are a lot of question marks. I think that there are a bunch of issues that are going to come up. I think that, you know, one of the, that last statement, I think, was really interesting, that Bo stated that governments have to be effectively nimble, which is, it's almost counterintuitive. They're just slow moving. They're slow by nature, right? And to get even to that point would be amazing, right? Like, you know, that something can happen. Now, is it impossible? Absolutely not. Like, again, if you have a place like Barcelona, their systems that they created make them more nimble. They're looking at real numbers in real time. They're gathering data. They're being transparent. So it is possible, but it's going to take a really radical shift. And it seems currently like it's almost moving in the opposite direction. It's becoming more opaque. It's becoming less conversational. So it would take kind of like a radical, I would say again, it's going to be a grind. It's going to be a grind. But I think, to your credit, and whether you brought us together for algorithmic amplification or not, I appreciate it. I think that there's something really amazing about just being able to have this conversation here. And I think we need more of this. And we need more, arguably, maybe like Bo alluded to, maybe the right people have to be there. Not all people, but the right people that are open and willing to listen to all these and to find some sort of way in between and through the fog. And I think that ideally, if we can do that, and I would argue that this, again, something is seemingly insignificant, but I think it is significant. So do you, I'm sure, because it's your podcast. But
feel like it's pretty insignificant. Yeah.
But I think that it's amazing to kind of come and to have this opportunity and to, you know, to watch Bo wave a piece of paper on and throw it down. And it's amazing. So I really appreciate that. And again, it gives me hope and optimism that we will get there.
Well, maybe we'll leave it there. But Bo, how can people find out more about what you're up to? And of course, West Group.
I retired from LinkedIn.
So
I can just...
It's a hot topic here. Yeah. This is the hot goss, everyone. We got this hot goss.
That actually is pretty hot gossip. I've heard that from a few people.
I always just say Google, right? Like, yeah. We're at West Group and we're still producing our Homes Don't Just Happen videos. Company that was helping us do it actually went into insolvency. Google, West Group.
We'll introduce you to Brady D over there after the show. and of course, Eric, how can people find out more about what you're up to?
Me, I do the writing side of things. Just Spacing Vancouver is where I do a lot of that stuff. I'm still on LinkedIn. I'm not a social media. I don't even have a phone. So I'm not a social media person and people are aghast. Just like, did anyone see? I don't know what you're going to do. You should have seen Matthew's face. It was just like, it was the most radical thing. If there was a bomb I ever threw, it was just that
you
one.
You should have led with that.
The rest of that stuff, whatever, power structures. You don't have a phone? What the hell is going on here? I don't. So I usually will go, I'll post just usually stuff about the publications on LinkedIn. I'll be like, look, I have, for those who are interested, here's something else that I've written. And then of course, I'm at the School of Community and Regional Planning, where you can always find me and you can, most people, I try to be as giving of my time for anybody who gives me and sends me an email or is like, I'd love to meet and talk about things. So feel free to reach out and, you know, you could just go on the UBC SCARP website and my email's there.
Fantastic. Well, thanks guys for your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
So there you have it, folks. The conclusion of the debate / dialogue with CEO and president of West Group, Bo Jarvis, and the UBC lecturer and editor-in-chief of Spacing Vancouver, Eric Villagomez.
Really enjoyed that conversation, Matt. I'm kind of sad that we don't have a part three to cut to next week, but I think everybody, we covered a lot of ground in this conversation. Yeah. If you have some comments about that, please share them on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or send us a DM or write a review online. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your thoughts. There's some pretty engaging dialogue happening on Spotify right now, so feel free to go there as well.
Yeah, and also, if you're finding any value at all with the podcast, of course, review or share with a friend. We've been forgetting to say that, but it's nice that it is how we grow. And we're always, if you're not growing, what do they say? I don't know. We're trying to keep the momentum alive here. So if you're enjoying it, share it with a friend or a family member. We really appreciate it. And you can also, of course, hit the VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com for things like private client services. This is our research tool that is great, that so many people find so useful to keep on top of the market. We have the Live Wire. We have the Sold Plan. There's so much going on over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com, so including our featured listing. So check it out.
And a final note, Matt, before we cut for the day, some incredible conversations. We just had an amazing interview with Dustin Woodhouse this past week that will be coming.
Richard Bell next week too.
Yeah, and Richard Bell coming on the show to talk about estate planning and how real estate ties into that. It's going to be a more broader conversation than that. But what we should say is very practical advice for people that own real estate or aspire to own real estate and estate planning. So lots of exciting stuff coming. Can't wait for that. And we're back next week. And Matt, if someone wants to get in touch, how can they reach out?
You can reach out at any time at 778-847-2854 or matt@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we got that Kokomo line info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Well, have a great week, and we're back here next week with another great episode.
2,000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.